Please be seated.
Good morning, everybody. We're here to hear oral argument in U.S. v. Seaton. Council ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Captain Neal, proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
My understanding you're reserving 5 minutes?
That's correct, Your Honor. Senior Judge Halgett, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Matthew Neal, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, I represent the United States in this matter. When this court reviews a military judge's decision to dismiss a charge and specification based on lost evidence under RCM 703, this court is bound by the factual determinations of the military judge, except where they are unsupported by the record or are clearly erroneous. This court considers the military judge's conclusions of law de novo. On questions of fact, this court asks whether the decision is reasonable. On questions of law, this court asks whether the decision is correct. If the answer to either question is no, then the military judge abused his discretion. That's United States versus Terry, 66 MJ 514 at 517, a published opinion from this court from 2008, dealing squarely with the issue that's before this court today. It's a decision that was first cited by trial counsel in Appellate Exhibit 13 in the response to the defense motion to dismiss. It's a published decision dealing with this issue that the military judge ignored in issuing his ruling. It's a published decision again cited by the government in our brief before this court. And again, just as the military judge did, ignored by appellee in his brief and his argument before this court.
Well, how did the military judge ignore this decision?
Your Honor, this decision is the premier decision from this court, published decision dealing with this issue of lost evidence and particularly analogous facts to this case issued by this court. And the military judge didn't even cite it in his ruling or in his discussion on the record of this case. For that reason, the United States would argue that the military judge ignored this controlling law when issuing his decision in this case. And the reason is simple. In this case, because the military judge's ruling isn't supported by the case law, and citing United States versus Terry would have contradicted the ruling that he ultimately came to. Because in coming to that ruling, the military judge relied on erroneous facts, on a misstatement of the standard and the law, and on an incorrect application of the law.
And so dealing with the standard of review, the military judge in his ruling had 16, I believe, numbered paragraphs in which he found facts. Which one of those 16, or ones of those 16, contained clearly erroneous statements?
Yes, Your Honor, and particularly what's important for this court for the clearly erroneous facts that were the predicate for the military judge's ruling were actually not contained within his paragraphs of statements of fact. They were actually under his law and discussion argument, but we'll give him the benefit that these were actually statements of fact. The two that are primarily important for this court's analysis and the decision in this case, first, that the military judge held the broad assertion that the video evidence in this case that was lost corroborated the statements of the appellee in this case. That statement was clearly erroneous when actually you consider the actual facts in this case. Particularly, I encourage the court to look at Appellate Exhibit 6. That's a 4-CD exhibit that contains a recorded interview of the appellee in this case. And when we review this, the United States' position is that you will find that approximately 1 minute and 25 seconds of that video is corroborated by the video evidence in this case. And that's a discussion on disc 1 of 4 at 56 minutes and 15 seconds to approximately 57 minutes and 40 seconds, which is when appellee discusses this incident of playing with the inflatable hammer in the hallway outside of the room. That is the only portion of his statements to OSI that are actually corroborated by this video evidence. In fact, if you really look at his statements and what he talks about, and then you look at what the video evidence actually showed, his statements are contradicted.
But we don't know what the video evidence actually showed.
We know what the video evidence actually showed because Tech Sergeant Simpson testified about what that video evidence showed. And notably, and we'll discuss this more in detail when talking about whether or not there's an adequate substitute, the military judge took no issue with the credibility of Tech Sergeant Simpson, also didn't find that Tech Sergeant Simpson was leaving out details or misremembering details from the video. So we do know with particularity and detail what that video showed, and most particularly, we know that it contradicted what the appellee said.
So one of your assertions is that the military judge was clearly erroneous in finding that the video contained exculpatory evidence. And where is that in the military judge's ruling? Which numbered paragraph?
One moment, Your Honor. Your Honor, on page 6 of the military judge's ruling, which is upon Exhibit 31, it's paragraph 37.
Is that one of the findings of fact?
We believe it is one of the findings of fact, even though it's not contained within his findings of fact section. His statement that the, because he's not applying the cooperation standard that we're used to, the term of art under NRA 304, he's simply comparing the video evidence to appellate statements or appellee statements and saying that these facts are the same, that they're corroborated. And so we would say that is a finding of fact. We'd give him that benefit of the doubt and still say that that finding of fact is clearly erroneous.
What other facts were clearly erroneous here?
The other fact that was clearly erroneous, Your Honor, goes to the issue of whether or not this video evidence could be used to impeach and the first class BB. Particularly what's clearly erroneous about the military judge's findings is that he found that she testified that the earlier incident never occurred, that she had never gone outside with the appellee, that they had never had any other interactions prior to the actual sexual assault. What she actually testified to, however, was that she couldn't remember if there was any other interaction, but she may have interacted with him at the smoke pit. And what's interesting about that is if you take it into context of the other facts that are in the record.
But that's not all. She testified to the amount of time she spent in the room.
That's correct, Your Honor. She did testify.
Is that consistent with the dorm manager's recollection?
It's not consistent in terms of the exact amount of time that she gave, but we would, the United States would argue that that's not even, at that point, if it had any impeachment value, would be minimal when we're talking about a witness who was sexually assaulted, who was under the influence of alcohol, and trying to relay the exact amount of time when she's not watching a clock. I think common sense would tell us that a normal individual is not going to be able to relate exact estimates of time. So we would say that impeachment value is minimal at best. And what we're really looking at is whether or not she could be impeached based upon these earlier events that she said she couldn't remember, as opposed to the unequivocal statement, no, this didn't happen. She didn't say that. She said, I can't recall. And this was an individual who had started drinking early in the day, drank multiple bottles of wine throughout the day, and so it's under that comment in that context when she's indicating that she couldn't remember exactly what interaction she had, which is certainly understandable given the facts of this case. So we would say that fact, his specific facts indicating what her testimony was clearly erroneous when you look at the facts of the case.
Okay, now Sam, go ahead, Judge.
Are there any other clearly erroneous findings of fact?
No, Your Honor, certainly not that's pertinent to this appeal. The remainder of our argument that we will be talking about are the conclusions of law.
So the government agrees that everything in numbered paragraphs 1 through 16 is, if not totally accurate, at least not clearly erroneous. Is that correct?
Well, not clearly erroneous, and more importantly, not pertinent to the decision in this case, because much of the facts before that have to do with certainly the bad faith and with exactly the sequence of events that happened in terms of the loss of the video, which under also 703 analysis, bad faith is not a factor for this court to consider or for the military judge to consider. He certainly, at the least, articulated that properly.
How does our Superior Court define a finding of fact? Specifically thinking of U.S. v. Cascio.
I can't think of exactly how Cascio decided.
Doesn't Cap and Cascio define a finding of fact and actually caution military judges to restrict their findings of fact to things, events, deeds, or circumstances that actually exist as distinguished from legal effect, consequence, or interpretation. Under that standard by our Superior Court, those two items that you assert are findings of fact, are they really findings of fact? Or are they legal effect, consequence, or interpretation?
Well, with regard to the military judge's finding with regard to exactly what Airman First Class BB testified to, that would be a finding of fact because this is what she said. And that, I would say, would be a finding of fact. However, under that analysis, and that's why we said we would give the military judge the benefit of the doubt, but certainly this court could conclude that the military judge saying that the appellate statements were corroborated by this video evidence, the United States is comfortable with this court finding that that's a conclusion of law and applying de novo review to that. Because under any standard, whether it's clearly erroneous or de novo, the United States is convinced that this court will conclude that that is an incorrect statement, either under a clearly erroneous standard or de novo review. So in a lot of ways, discussing whether or not that's a finding of fact versus a conclusion of law, at least under our view, is an academic exercise because under any standard, it fails.
It's a comparison of facts.
That's what we would describe that as well, Your Honor. That he is comparing, he's marrying up, he's saying this is appellee's statement, This is the video evidence, so these facts are the same. And they're not. And whether it's a conclusion of law, which this court can look at de novo and compare it for yourself, and I encourage this court to do so, or this court determines that that is, in fact, a finding of fact, and you can still compare and determine that that's clearly erroneous because you actually have appellee statements and you have the evidence of what was on that video. So that's why I would argue under any standard it would fail. Moving on now to the actual conclusions of law, which were patently incorrect in this case. The military judge, the first area I'd like to talk about is that he determined that this evidence was of central importance to an issue that made it essential to a fair trial. The military judge never went through any analysis, and while this court certainly is applying the de novo review, looking at this anew and looking at it for yourself anyway, I should be inclined to give no deference to the military judge's ruling because he doesn't even go through an analysis of why it's of central importance, and he applies the incorrect standard, and this is why. What he says is a mistake of fact is to consent and consent. Now, talk about those together because the argument is the same. Those issues are of central importance to this case, so this evidence is obviously a violation of Article 703, and the case must be dismissed. But he goes through absolutely no analysis of why.
Doesn't he talk about the victim's testimony and the victim's credibility being key to determining whether consent or mistake of fact as to consent existed? And then he further explains why this missing evidence may impact her credibility.
He does talk about the credibility and how it may impact her credibility. Judge Weber, that's a good question. However, I would not agree with the characterization that he actually goes through any analysis of connecting those two. He simply makes these statements and then says these issues are of central importance. And talking about the credibility, it's a good point to bring that up. The military judge, and this is where it's important that the military judge ignored published precedent from this court in the United States versus Terry. Simply being of possible impeachment value is not enough for evidence to be, even in a sexual assault or rape case where the only testimony about the actual event comes from the victim herself, simply being of some impeachment value is not enough to be of central importance to an issue to make it essential to a fair trial. And we know that from United States versus Terry. In that case, the defense wanted to argue at trial that the victim who had testified, unlike the victim in this case, Aaron First Class BB, the victim in Terry actually testified multiple times and gave statements, unequivocal statements, that the accused was not wearing a condom throughout the rape, that he was not wearing a condom. One of the pieces of evidence that had been seized was actually a condom that the defense wanted to use to prove that he was in fact wearing a condom, an actual fact about the actual assault, that he was wearing a condom during it. And this court actually presumed that the evidence would show what the defense wanted it to and still held that it was not of such central importance as to make it essential to a fair trial. This court stated, the addition of this piece of impeachment evidence, the condom in that case, would add little to what is already available to the appellee. We conclude that even if the testing of the condoms had yielded such a result, such evidence is not of central importance to an issue essential to a fair trial. That's Terry at 519. What that tells us is simply being of some impeachment value isn't enough. And in this case, the minimal impeachment value of impeaching her on these past events based upon her testimony that she doesn't remember, which is not an unequivocal statement that these things didn't occur, is minimal at best and is really about peripheral details. And the appellee in this case, going a step further and bleeding a little bit into the adequate substitute, has everything he needs to impeach her about those events. He has the contradiction through the testimony of Tech Sergeant Simpson. And certainly, the members don't need to see a video to be able to impeach the testimony of Emma First Class BB with that evidence in this case.
How do we know what we don't know here? How do we know that there wasn't other potentially exculpatory evidence on the video, particularly given the fact that the dorm manager testified that it had been a year, he didn't remember everything, and he fast-forwarded through portions, and he only remembered big things, not little things?
Yes, Your Honor, and this will bleed in large respect to the discussion of the adequate substitute, so I'll discuss that while discussing this because I think it is important. First off, the standard is not, do we know or we don't know? As United States versus Terry told us in finding the similar type of video evidence showing the interactions or showing the movements of the victim and the accused in that case outside of the room where the assault took place would only show their interactions or their movements through the hospital before and after the assault was not of such central importance. And what they held was, but we don't know is not enough. That's pure speculation. And appellee didn't cite to any particular facts that Tech Sergeant Simpson got wrong. even in the cross-examination of him, it was, it's been a year. You remember the big details, and he's, I remember the big details. I remember the intricate details. But Appelli never cited to any particular details that would be important to his case that are missing. He asked the exact same questions that you asked, Judge Webber, which is not the standard in this case, is how do we know? How do we know? It's their burden to show that it's not adequate, that this is of central importance. It's not enough to say we don't know what we don't know. And more importantly, Tech Sergeant Simpson, while he said I remember the big details and maybe not some of the intricate ones, which might be timestamps, first off, the fast-forwarding, he fast-forwarded through dead space. He fast-forwarded through time when Appelli and Amber first called BB1 on the screen. He testified that he watched the interactions between them. He watched this video, and he gave intricate detail about timelines, about what actually occurred. And I encourage this court to look closely at his testimony, particularly on the record at page 191, when he actually corrects the military judge and defense counsel when they're asking him about a very intricate detail. And that intricate detail is Airman First Class BB's drink. He testifies that she had this drink in her hand and she put it down. And then the later question, when she was running around, she had this drink in her hand. No, she didn't. And then the military judge jumps in and asks for a clarification. He says, well, she came in when she's first in the video, she has a drink in her hand, but she places it down before she's running around with the hammer. That's a pretty intricate detail. The facial expressions that Appelli had, looking distraught, looking nervous, that's an intricate detail. And what's most important is these details that they talk about, that Appelli talked about at trial, particularly with this kiss and this pinky promise that Appelli talks about in his interview with OSI. He doesn't say, I don't recall if that happened. And he's never cross-examined him. They don't say, well, it's possible that happened and you don't remember. And they don't cross-examine him on that. Why? Because he gave unequivocal statements. This is on the record when they ask him, again, at 191, were there any physical interactions with him? No, besides the hug. He says, unequivocally, there was no kiss. There was no pinky promise. The only physical interaction on the tape was the hug itself. So then when you review his testimony, he actually does remember the intricate details, including timelines, and the intricate details that he doesn't remember is simply timestamps, the exact times. So I would disagree with the assertion that this is not an adequate substitute, first off, based upon that. And also, we have to look back at what the military judge actually held. And what he held with regard to this evidence was effectively that a witness testimony can never be an adequate substitute for video evidence. Because the military judge didn't take issue with Tech Sergeant Simpson's memory.
What other evidence, in your proof analysis and the case in chief to be presented, what other evidence is there going to be, would there potentially be presented to the fact finder to make a determination of guilt?
Well, Your Honor, there's certainly the appellee statements to OSI, which the United States would argue are very inculpatory, especially given the fact that one of the arguments that appellee makes is that, in his brief, is that Amber First Class BB never said stop. She never said stop. Well, she doesn't just give us that. If you look at his interview, again, on disc one, starting at 1 hour and 12 minutes to 1 hour and 13 minutes, she said it wasn't a good idea and we should stop. 1 hour and 13 minutes to 1 hour and 14 minutes. She said, I have a boyfriend and we should stop. She then said for a third time, we should stop. He goes on with this 2 of 4 of Appellate Exhibit 6 to talk about the fact that Air First Class BB told him to stop. And what's really important about that, too, is how inculpatory statements are truly shown by the defense's or Appellate's motion to suppress those very statements at trial. He recognizes the inculpatory nature of those statements and doesn't want them before the finder of fact. So there's certainly that evidence as well as the testimony of Air First Class BB, the testimony of her boyfriend as well, who she reported to immediately with regard to what happened, would be evidence that we would expect the government would present at trial when this goes back to trial.
And the source of all this evidence is?
The source of the evidence with regard to Appellee's interview is the recorded interview of Appellee.
The source of the evidence that is inculpatory is?
Both the testimony of Amber First Class BB, which is primarily, it's the testimony of the victim, as you would expect in almost all of the
cases. Where there's other evidence, there's evidence that was collected from the scene, etc.
Well,
in this case, it is purely the testimony of BB.
It is the testimony of Amber First Class BB. However, Your Honor, United States versus Terry, there was actually other evidence that was collected that was destroyed. And the issue in that case is whether or not the sexual encounter was by force and without consent. And this court held that if it was impeaching the victim in that case, that a fact that was about, as we talked about, the condiment, the fact that was central to the actual encounter, that was actually a fact about the rape, was not enough to make it of central importance because they had ample evidence from her other statements to attack whether or not it was by force and without consent. Just as in this case, apparently he has ample evidence, both to impeach her, they have the testimony of Tech Sergeant Simpson, they also have the testimony of the Facebook post that referenced this plastic hammer. And as far as what happened in the room, the video doesn't show that anyway. And as we know from United States versus Terry, if it just showed what's happened before and what happens after, that's not of central importance and really is no impeachment value to what happened in the room. And what you have to impeach her with at trial is the fact that she testified and she will say that the first 5 to 6 minutes of this sexual encounter were consensual. That she was kissing him, she engaged in consensual sexual intercourse, and then she told him to stop. So the question becomes, did he continue after she said stop? Which he also gives us in his Appellate Exhibit 6 in his recorded interview. He says at one point that he went several thrusts after she told him to stop the last time.
We are familiar with the facts, and you know his account certainly agrees that she said stop, but he also told OSI that he did honor that request. And, you know, their stories diverge from there. Reads between the lines of the military judge's ruling. While he did not find bad faith, and this is, I think the government now agrees, is just an RCM 703 case, right? We're not dealing with a due process Article 46 violation, right?
That's correct, Judge Weber.
So he did not find bad faith. However, I think it's fair to say he seemed somewhat bothered by the actions of OSI in this case. The fact that OSI knew the video would only be around for 14 days, but waited until day 15 or 16 to go and collect it. The fact that when they found out it was gone, the OSI agent took no steps to preserve that evidence by taking statements from the OSI agents or the dorm manager who watched it. The fact that the OSI agent noted nothing in the ROI about the existence or the disappearance of the video. The fact that when trial counsel asked him if there was a video from that night, the OSI agent said no, mentioning nothing about the previous existence of the video. What relevance is there to the actions of OSI in this case?
Under the RCM 703 analysis, Your Honor, we would say none.
So when we're talking about the underlying standard of RCM 703 being, did the accused receive a fair trial, the actions of OSI have nothing to do with whether he received a fair trial?
Your Honor, under RCM 703, the question is whether or not this evidence is of central importance as to make it essential to a fair trial, and whether or not the accused's rights can be adequately protected. Whether or not OSI retrieved this video or not does not come into play for an RCM 703 analysis. But what I would point this court to, if this court is looking at the actions of OSI, what the military judge did talk about is the standards of fair play. And when you actually look at the higher standard, when we're talking about apparently exculpatory evidence that's destroyed, if we are talking about Brady material, if we are talking about due process, even our superior court has said, while it is disturbing that the Chief of Military Justice would concur with disposing of evidence prior to the completion of the appellate process, poor judgment or even ineptitude does not equal bad faith. And that's only that the evidence was proper to come in. This court has looked at much more egregious facts than what we have here, because what we have is OSI agents who viewed the video, who wanted to obtain it that day, but the door manager didn't know how. That's clear from the record. They wanted to get the video, and they couldn't because of that, and they were going to leave it to the case agent. They testified that they left that meeting with the impression that the dorm manager would go to isolate it. And what we also know is that, yes, they didn't return until day 16, and these are normally overwritten at day 15. A typhoon also hit approximately 5 days after this incident and reset the system anyway. And this is why we didn't discuss much of the actions of OSI, because for the RCM 703 analysis, it's simply looking at the evidence itself. Not the actions of OSI, because we have gone out of the due process analysis because the military judge expressly held that the agents did not act in bad faith. And for that reason, we don't think the actions of OSI factor into whether or not this evidence is of central importance, whether or not there's an adequate substitute, and whether or not the military judge, even if there was a violation of RCM 703, instituted a proper remedy in this case. I think it's similar also to what this court said in United States versus Terry when it was looking at the actions of law enforcement, of OSI, and the legal office in disposing the evidence, similar to Blaney. In the meantime, so now this evidence isn't helpful, it doesn't matter, so we're going to destroy it. They took issue, they found that problematic as well, but that wasn't a factor in the RCM 703 analysis.
It's true, though, that the appellee, during his interview with OSI, is the one that initiated and urged OSI to actually obtain the video.
I'm glad you brought up, Judge Pellequin. That's not a true statement of fact. Certainly, that was cited by Paulina's brief. That was brought out in cross-examination of OSI agents. But the true facts of what actually happened with regard to the drone video, if you even look at Special Agent Hayden's testimony, it wasn't those words. It wasn't those exact words. What actually happened, and I see I'm out of time, so Judge Harvey, may I finish answering the question?
Finish.
Thank you, Your Honor. What actually happened, if you look at disc 2 of 4, and this is between minute 1 minute and 10 seconds to 1 minute and 20 seconds, this is where the discussion of the drone video actually happens. It's OSI that brings it up, and it's after Appellee gives his version of events, his version of what happened after they left the room, and he talks about walking down the stairs to the parking lot and then to Amber First Class BB's room. They say, well, we can go up and look at the drone video. Is that going to show you all walking down the stairs and show what you said? Appellee's response is, the video will show us going into the stairs, but it won't show us on the stairs because there's a camera in the hall, not on the stairs. That was his statement in Appellee Exhibit 6. And certainly through all of you, and what I would urge this court is not to take our word for it or Appellee's word in his brief, but actually review Appellee Exhibit 6, because the only other discussion of the video is on disc 3 at 39 minutes and 30 seconds to 39 minutes and 40 seconds. The question was actually asked by OSI. If we pull the drone video, will we just see her walking normal and asking whether or not she was stumbling? Appellee's simple response to that was yes, which we also know from the actual drone video is also contradicted by that drone video, because Amber First Class BB was stumbling and walked into a wall. So when you review Appellee Exhibit 6, we're confident you'll see that the drone video was brought up by OSI, and it wasn't Appellee urging them to actually go get it or to preserve any drone video. That was the discussion that's contained on Appellee Exhibit 6.
But one of the OSI agents also testified that if he were the accused, he would want that video. Is that correct?
That is correct for the OSI agent testified, but what I would say to that, Judge Weber, is that whether an OSI agent would want it if he was an accused is not a factor in this court's analysis under RCM 703. Certainly you can look at the testimony of the OSI agents taken in context. What would be most important in this case, however, is what the video evidence actually showed, the other evidence that was out there, and the adequate substitute that the appellee had through the testimony of Tech Sergeant Simpson. And now that I'm out of time, so Judge Hubbard, I'll address remedy on my time I've reserved for rebuttal if there are no further questions.
Thank you. Captain King.
Good morning, Senior Judge Helgert, Judge Pellequin, Judge Weber. I am Captain Isaac Kinnon, and I'm joined by Colonel Pat Wells, and we represent the appellee in this case, Airman First Class Stephen Seaton. May it please the Court. The government stated that the appellee contests the standard of review that this Court will need to apply. The appellee does not. In our brief, we conceded that the government largely stated the standard review correctly, and we don't challenge that now. We just add one additional element to it, which is that the question is whether the judge's decisions were fairly supported by the record, and that's in United States versus Baker, 70 MJ 287. And the judge's decisions in this case were fairly supported by the record. The judge made his determination purely on RCM 703 after considering the due process clause basis in Article 46 and RCM 701. The judge relied upon RCM 703 in deciding that the appropriate remedy for the loss of this dormitory video was dismissal of the charges. And there was... That decision was fairly supported in the record. The question for all of us in this room, and particularly for this honorable court, is not whether any of us would do the same thing were we sitting on a trial bench. The question is, was the judge's decision fairly supported in the record? And it was in this case. That the judge's findings of fact are supported throughout the record, and the appellee attempted to aid the court by citing to specific portions of the rot that support each of the 16 paragraphs of finding of fact that the trial judge found. But the conclusions of law are also fairly supported by the record. There is evidence to support each of the judge's conclusions of law. A conclusion of law doesn't occur in a vacuum. The question is whether there's evidence to support it. So the government points to its belief that the appellant's testimony would not be corroborated by the video, but also concedes that some portions of the testimony would. Well, that is a conclusion of law. The appellee agrees that is not a finding of fact. That is a conclusion of law, and it was supported by the judge's by evidence in the record, the judge's conclusion that there would be some corroboration of the appellee's version of events was supportable. The second assignment of error that the government alleges is that impeachment would not have been possible, and the military judge erred in finding that it would have been possible by asserting that the video evidence didn't directly contradict the complaining witness's testimony. But that's a very narrow interpretation of what it means to impeach a witness. We don't always only impeach witnesses by evidence of direct contradiction. We also impeach by showing bias or showing the inability of the witness to accurately recall significant and important facts. And those grounds for impeachment are just as important as confronting a witness with a direct contradiction. In fact, in this case, where the complaining witness's testimony is truly the only testimony in the case that could show a lack of consent, her ability... I'm sorry.
So there's a presumption that the complainant would testify at trial consistent with the 32 testimony.
Your Honor, I would say that the presumption is that we're not entirely sure what the complaining witness would testify to at trial.
So if the complaining witness testifies wholly consistent with the dorm manager's recollection of what's on the video and wholly consistent with the defendant up until the door closes at the dorm, then what does the video do for you?
If the complaining witness were to testify, Your Honor, that she actually does recall significant interactions with the appellant prior to the alleged incident and did not testify to that at the 32 for whatever reason, lack of recollection or intentional falsification, then there would be grounds for cross-examination. But there would also be grounds to offer that evidence, that video as substantive evidence to show the extent of her deficient recollection of events and the extent of her lacking reliability as a witness. It essentially goes to her competence as a witness, not necessarily that she would be lying, but that she's not a competent purveyor of facts in that court-martial, and that is provable by extrinsic evidence, and that's established in United States versus Sojfer. It's S-O-J-F-E-R, and that's 47 MJ 425 with a pinpoint site of 427. That evidence showing that a witness lacks the ability to accurately recall pertinent details is grounds for impeachment, and that the defense can offer that by extrinsic evidence. That's
but in that case, then you'd be using it to impeach the 32 testimony. In my scenario, if she were to testify wholly consistent with what you purport the video to show, what is there to impeach?
Well, that would be...
My point being, isn't the military judge premature in the ruling at this point?
I don't believe the military judge is premature, Your Honor. The government had the opportunity to offer testimony at the motions hearing and to establish that she would testify inconsistently with her Article 32 testimony. If the government thought that that would remedy the situation and eliminate the need for impeachment evidence, then it was incumbent upon the government to produce that evidence for the military judge to show that what appears to be the truth, what appears her prior testimony subject to cross-examination under oath, is inconsistent with her 1168 that she provided to OSI. If that was going to be remedied at trial, then the military judge couldn't have known that because the government didn't call her to offer that testimony.
Well, let me ask this. With respect to this video, there's two parts. There's an interaction between the victim and the accused before the alleged encounter, and then there's some interaction between them afterwards.
Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of the essentiality of this video and how relevant it is, the critical time, I think, that's important here is what happened inside the room. So the fact that they had some encounter that she claims she doesn't remember beforehand, okay, so why not some kind of a remedy from the judge? We'll stipulate that they had some encounter before that. But really, if that encounter was they played games for 2 hours, they made out for 2 hours, that doesn't change, does it? What happened inside the room when she allegedly said no and he didn't stop? That's at least according to her. So how relevant then, or how crucial is this video then to the appellant's case or the appellee's case?
Well, Your Honor, the first thing I would point out that it directly contradicts some of the facts that occurred in the dormitory room, specifically the time frame that she alleges.
Can she stipulate to that, though?
Possibly.
As a remedy?
But then that is a possible solution.
You don't need to see a video to know how long she's in there, right?
For that specific point, that is correct, Your Honor. But the true value of this evidence is that it demonstrates the degree to which her recollection is faulty. That every single time she had an interaction with the accused outside of that dormitory room and can't recall it would tend to indicate to members that she's not a reliable witness as to the facts and circumstances of the offense, which would make them believe her less regarding her recollection of events inside the dormitory room.
The true value in this video is to impeach her rather than to demonstrate consent leading up to the encounter in the dorm room. Why isn't the dorm manager's testimony sufficient? Because the dorm manager provided at least 3 points of evidence on which the defense could rely to impeach her.
Well, Your Honor, I think you pointed out that the dorm manager also fast-forwarded through a great deal of that 7 to 8 hour video, and he testified that there were interactions between the appellee and the complaining witness during that time that he fast-forwarded through. And he also testified that he only recalls big incidents that he did view, that he wasn't fast-forwarding through at OSI's insistence, that he also doesn't accurately recall or doesn't believe he accurately recalls minutiae and intricate details. And each of those things are important to establish not only a mistake of fact defense. The military judge dealt with that defense extensively in the ruling, which is why I didn't jump on it as much in this argument. But it also serves the interest of being able to impeach the witness regarding the reliability of her recollection, that she supposedly recalls details inside the dormitory room while completely having no recollection of vast swaths of intricate interaction with the appellee outside of the dormitory room, and where the dormitory video would be able to tangibly show that to the members. This happened and she doesn't recall it. This happened and she doesn't recall it. She's being chased with an inflatable hammer and she doesn't recall that. All of that serves to powerfully demonstrate to members that her recollection is unreliable, and therefore she cannot be believed regarding what she said or didn't say or maybe should have said during the alleged offense when she tells him that we shouldn't be doing this.
Well, then I want to go back to Judge Pelquin's question.
Yes, Your Honor.
It depends upon, doesn't it, how she testifies in court before you know, or any of us know, what the impeachment value of that video would be? I mean, if she were to testify, she remembers what happened, she remembered playing the game or whatever, then does the video then, would the video impeach her at that point? Isn't the military judge's ruling here a little premature?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. We have no reason to believe. The military judge who had to make the decision there on the bench and hearing the evidence, had no reason to believe that her testimony would be any different than the testimony she offered under oath at the Article 32 investigation, subject to cross-examination and subject to questioning by the investigating officer. There's absolutely no reason for the military judge to believe her testimony would be otherwise. We would be reading in a requirement that this sworn testimony from a judicial sort of proceeding is not reliable, and judges can't make determinations on motions based on that. And that doesn't further the interests of judicial economy. And further, the existence of that Article 32 testimony is fair evidence in the record upon which the military judge could rely. The question is not whether it would be better for the military judge to make the litigants try the whole case before deciding the motion. The question is, given the evidence in front of him at the time, was the judge's decision fairly supported? And it was. There was fair support for finding that her testimony would contradict the Article 32 testimony, which contradicted. I'm
so
sorry,
counsel, let me ask you. Do you believe the military judge making findings and then determining there should be a remedy would have a whole range of remedies available to him? Is there anything that would preclude him from issuing a remedy at this point in time that would preclude him from subsequently issuing another remedy? My point being is he took the ultimate remedy, dismissal with prejudice. Could he have offered a remedy of government defense, enter into a stipulation of fact, come back to me and we'll see if that satiates me and my concerns before going to the ultimate remedy? Would there be anything to prevent him from taking that course of action?
No, Your Honor. The case law is clear that it is at the discretion of the trial judge to determine the appropriate remedy, and I don't see any reason that you couldn't have sort of a tiered approach to. But the question is not whether he could have done that or even whether he should have done that. The question is, was his approach not fairly supported by the record? Was it an abuse of discretion for him to take the approach he did?
I'll ask you the same question I asked government counsel. What relevance do the actions of OSI have to the military judge's analysis and our analysis as to whether RCM 703 was violated?
Your Honor, the appellee actually agrees with the government that it goes more to bad faith, which is a concern under the constitutional standard or Article 46. It is not a concern under RCM 703. So the judge's order dealt with that because he had to deal with that in order to resolve the Article 46 allegation. And so he considered all of that evidence, found that the evidence was indicative of maybe negligence, but not necessarily bad faith, and therefore there was no remedy available under Article 46 or RCM 701. That's why the judge dealt in great detail with that evidence, because he needed to do that to decide whether relief was warranted under one of those greater standards. And ultimately, that's why he relied upon RCM 703, because it doesn't require bad faith. But I don't think we can read into that somehow he was considering the undesirable actions of OSI in this case in deciding to grant relief under RCM 703. He appeared to explicitly say he was not, and to clearly delineate, I'm considering bad faith for relief under Article 46, or he didn't specifically cite the Due Process Clause, but he did cite Trombetta and Youngblood, so he clearly was thinking about the Due Process Clause, but that doesn't mean that that was tainting his view under RCM 703. I don't think we have any reason to believe otherwise.
I've got a question on U.S. v. Kern.
Yes, sir.
You're talking about remedies, and you say the military judge has full discretion. There's language in here, and let me just read it to you. It says, some suggested remedial actions include, 1, exclusion of inculpatory evidence, requiring the government to stipulate as to the facts and circumstances surrounding the loss or destruction of the exculpatory evidence, and we've discussed that. 3, requiring the government to stipulate as to the fact or condition of the evidence. And then four, or even dismissal, and this is after a semicolon, or even dismissal of charges or specifications where bad faith is clearly demonstrated. If you don't have bad faith, then is dismissal of charges and dismissal of charges an authorized remedy?
No, for Article 46, which is exactly, and that is what Kearns is dealing with, is the appellant in that case asserted a violation of Article 46, or it may have been the appellee, because I believe that that was an Article 62 appeal as well. But they did not raise an allegation of a 703 violation. And that was because, in Kearns, that was not dealing with exculpatory or even arguably exculpatory evidence. That was dealing with purely inculpatory evidence, which Article 46 applies to because it gives the right to equal access to the evidence. And so the judge was analyzing, or the court was analyzing, under the Article 46 analysis, which does require bad faith. Appellee concedes that. But we're not talking about Article 46 here. We're talking about RCM 703, which explicitly does not require bad faith. This court has found as much in United States versus Terry, 66 NJ 514 at Penn Site 518. This honorable court said, the first thing to note about this rule, speaking of RCM 703, is it eliminates the requirement for an accused to establish bad faith on the part of the government in order to obtain relief. And the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces took no issue with this court's recitation of that standard when it denied review in 66 MJ 380, because that is the correct standard for RCM 703. It just makes sense. The president intended to provide additional protections to military accused that Congress did not provide in Article 46 and that our founders didn't provide in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. The president has provided greater protections, and the way in which RCM 703 is differentiated from those other standards is that bad faith is not required. Your Honor, I spoke some about the value of this evidence to showing the deficiencies in the complaining witness's memory, which is crucially important when she is the only witness that can testify that, in her view, there was some expression of lack of consent. But I also want to talk about some about the reasonable mistake of fact defense, that the way in which this evidence, which she heretofore is not corroborated, shows and would tend to show the appellee that she's consenting to sexual activity beyond the fact that she'd consented to sexual activity up until that point. But the amorous hug in the hallways prior to the offense, the sort of horseplay that occurred, chasing each other with inflatable toys and that sort of thing, and going outside, and that's not recorded, that what occurred outside, but there is recordings of them going outside together where the appellee says that they proceeded to roll around on the ground and that sort of thing. All of that is indicative. It's a course of action on her behalf that would help the appellee be able to show the members that he reasonably believed she was consenting. And when you talk, when you add to that the very caveated nature of her supposed expression of lack of consent, all of that becomes even more important and relevant. What she told the appellee is that, basically, I'm engaged to be married and we shouldn't be doing this. But there's no reason to believe that they didn't both know that before they started having consensual intercourse. So stating the obvious to him in the middle of the intercourse, there's no reason to believe that that would make him believe that she wanted to stop. And so he could have a reasonable mistake of fact as to whether she was consenting. And that totality of circumstances leading up to their entering into the dormitory room helps establish that. And it is important for that reason. And the military judge did not err in finding that it was important for that reason.
Would you agree that the probative value of any such evidence of their conduct leading up to the events in the dorm room is lessened by the fact that she admits that she began intercourse consensually?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. It is definitely diminished, but it is not washed away. And the question, again, before this court is, was the judge's decision fairly supported in the record? And some value to the evidence doesn't mean it has no value. And so it is still of value, and it is still important for the members to hear in determining ultimate issues of guilt and whether there was a mistake of fact, and essentially whether he had the mens rea to commit the offense, which is the goal of the court-martial in the first place. And this was critical evidence that was denied the appellee because of the actions of the government, negligent or otherwise, and that you can't, there was no fair trial under RCM 703 that could be had absent that evidence. Absent further questions, I request permission to close, Your Honor.
Questions? Proceed.
Your Honor, the question before this court is whether the military judge's decisions and findings of fact were fairly supported in the record. They were in this case. The evidence that was lost or destroyed would have established important facts for the members to consider, and therefore there was no fair trial that could be had. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. To begin with the standard of review, Your Honors, appellee argues that the standard of review as articulated by the government was correct, but yet this court should apply the same standard of review to both facts and law. And this is a result of appellee's complete misreading of United States versus Baker, which is 70 MJ 283, Rush Superior Court in 2011. And particularly what the United States believes is leading to this misunderstanding of the standard of review is the quote in that case that said, when a court is limited to reviewing matters of law, the question is not whether a reviewing court might disagree with the trial court's findings, but whether those findings are fairly supported by the record. At its outset, in United States versus Baker, as we know, as attorneys, as a judge, we know that words are important from our case law. It's talking about findings, which are findings of fact. Conclusions of law is a separate analysis. It's de novo, review anew by this court. This is also supported when you actually peel it back and look where this quote came from. This quote from United States versus Baker comes from United States versus Gore, which is 60 MJ 178, and that's at 185. It's our Superior Court from 2004, specifically talking about findings of fact. And in fact, this quote actually goes on. The next sentence to this quote is, to give due deference to the trial bench, a determination of fact should not be disturbed unless it is unsupported by the evidence of record or was clearly erroneous. And that's citing United States versus Burris, 21 MJ 140 at 144, the Court of Military Appeals in 1985. Interestingly enough, and notably, United States versus Terry, published opinion from this court dealing with this very issue that's before this court, rested its decision talking about the standard of review on United States versus Burris. So this court was applying the correct standard there and not applying a misreading of the standard that appellee would have this court to do here today.
So there are only two components to the abuse of discretion standard is the government's position. Pure findings of fact, what actually exists, clearly erroneous. Everything else is a de novo review. Is that the government's position?
That is the government's position.
So the military judge gets no deference in applying the facts to the law to reach a conclusion?
No. The United States will argue it is a de novo review by this court whether or not the military judge is correct.
So every judgment call that a trial judge makes essentially is subject to de novo review?
It's not, Your Honor, because there are particular areas in the law where the military judge is granted discretion in terms of what rulings a conclusion of law, applying facts to law, and that most particularly apt to discuss is a balancing test. So, for instance, for MLA 403 balancing tests, we know from our Superior Court and from consistent case law that when a military judge does a balancing test and he articulates it on the record, he's going to get greater deference. And what I would actually even add on to that is even if this court were inclined to think that the military judge should get any deference, this case where he didn't actually articulate, contrary to the appellee's argument, he didn't articulate why this evidence was of such central importance. He just said it was related to an issue that was of central importance, which isn't the standard. He didn't even cite the correct law, didn't even bother to cite the controlling case law, published case law on this very issue from this court. in reaching his decision. So even if this court were inclined to give him any deference, the United States would argue that he should receive none anyway because he didn't articulate his conclusions correctly. And also, I think this is supported, our argument is supported, when you actually look at the way in the United States versus Terry, this court addressed the decisions of the military judge that evidence was of central importance or that there wasn't an adequate substitute for it. They didn't look at it and say, well, these are clearly erroneous, or we're going to give deference to this military judge. When you read the opinion, it's very clear from that opinion that they applied their own review to it. This court, in its published opinion, applied their own de novo review to those conclusions by the military judge. So I think that supports the argument that findings of facts are clearly erroneous, and statements of the law and application of those facts to the law, which are the conclusions of law, is a de novo review. To talk about briefly about remedy, Senior Judge Halbert, you hit the nail on the head. United States versus Kern, which I think is very formative in this case, and you quote that. And Kern, contrary to Appellee's argument, Kern actually was talking about both exculpatory and inculpatory evidence. While the evidence at issue in that case was inculpatory, what the Kern court held was that an accused is entitled to both, equally entitled to inculpatory and exculpatory evidence. And that is made apparent from the quote that was read by U.S. Senior Judge Helgett that talks about one of the remedies is requiring the government to stipulate as to the facts and circumstances surrounding the loss or destruction of the exculpatory evidence. So this, what it's talking about with regard to remedy is talking about the loss of exculpatory evidence. So if we have a case where we're talking about exculpatory evidence, materially or that's apparently exculpatory, and the current court says that you can't dismiss in that case unless there's bad faith, certainly when we're talking about a lower standard of evidence that's of central importance to an issue that's essential to a fair trial, the current court is certainly binding on this.
And how do you square your position with United States versus Manuel, where the court explicit in an RCM 703 context, not an Article 46 context, explicitly approved a remedy of dismissal of charges?
I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Proceed.
And thank you for that question, Judge Weber, because that's the case that the military judge and appellate actually relied on in saying that dismissal is appropriate. At the outset, what the military judge failed to recognize in his ruling, and appellee has failed to recognize as well, is that Manuel was limited by our superior court. It was narrowly decided on the facts of that case. It was a narrow opinion based upon this. The evidence at question in United States versus Manuel was the only evidence of the crime committed. It was a urine sample. And the actual issue at trial, given the low nanogram level, was whether or not the nanogram level was accurate on the result, so they wanted to retest the sample. The sample was actually destroyed in contravention of Air Force regulations, and this court held that Air Force regulations, at least with regard to urine samples, bestowed a substantial right upon an accused. And it was that finding that our Superior Court said we are not going to disturb, and on the narrow facts of this case, dismissal was an appropriate remedy. They, in fact, went on to say that this court is not going to hold that dismissal is an appropriate remedy in all cases for a military judge, simply on the facts of this case. That's why I think this court needs to go back to the analysis of United States versus Kerr, which is applicable to this case, as well as the United States versus Terry, which really looks at the issue under RCM 703. And Senator Jarvis, if I may conclude?
You may.
In this case, the military judge abused his discretion in finding a violation of RCM 703, and in imposing a draconian remedy not appropriate on the facts of this case. In order to reach that ruling, the military judge had found erroneous facts, applied incorrect standard of the law, and in fact even applied a law RCM 701, which is wholly inapplicable to this case, given the facts of this case. The military judge, in reaching this ruling, ignored the clear, established, published case law of this court and of our superior court in reaching each of his decisions in this case. This was case law that was cited to him by the trial counsel in their response to the motion. This is case law that is not hard to find on a quick search on Westlaw. The United States Air Force deserves better. Air Force Class BB deserves better. Justice deserves better. The United States asks that this court remedy this miscarriage of justice and promptly reverse the military judge's decision and send this case back for trial so that justice can be done. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank both sides for very good arguments, very helpful, and we'll issue our opinion in due course, and we're adjourned.